The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, when will humans return to the surface of the moon? How is space exploration affected by international political tensions? What astronauts think of Hollywood's recent forays into space? We speak to Frank de Winner, head of the European Astronaut Centre in Cologne. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Frank de Winner is a former Belgian Air Force test pilot and the first ever European commander of the International Space Station. In 2002, Frank flew a 9-day mission to the ISS and a 6-month mission in 2009. During his long-duration mission, he was the main operator of the Japanese robotic arm to dock Japan's HTV cargo ship. He now heads the European Astronaut Centre, which recruited 6 new astronauts in 2009. One of the 6 is the UK's Tim Peake, who's scheduled to make his first flight to the International Space Station in December. I caught up with Frank in Cologne last week and began by asking him how the qualifications needed to become an astronaut differ now from the Apollo era.
I think it's a little bit different, of course, than what it is in the Apollo area, because there we were especially doing a lot of testing. So we were looking especially for test pilots and people that had done all this kind of dangerous flying, I would say, with aircraft at those eras as well. Today it's much more based on technology. It's much more based on science. It's much more based on international cooperation, living together. So especially the profile, the psychological profile of our people is extremely important. If you sit with 6 people from different nationalities for 6 months in a tin can floating above our Earth, then of course you need to be able to adapt to those people. You need to be able to adapt to the different cultures. You need to be able to work. You need to be able to lead, to follow. And so this is extremely important in today's right stuff for the astronauts.
You have thousands of people apply when you advertise for astronauts. Do you struggle to find people with the right skills, the right breadth of skills, and to the right level that you really want to see?
Here in Europe, for sure, we don't have any problems in finding the right people. We don't do selections so often. And when we do a selection, like in 2009, when Tim was selected, we have more than 10,000 people applying. So for sure, within those people, we find the people that both are medically fit, that have a good education, because that's also important. We are looking for engineers, for doctors, for scientists, but also people that have the right psychological profile. And I must say that with the selection that we have made, the 6 new young guys, we are extremely pleased because they are all performing extremely well. They are very well seen by our international partners. And we have now had 4 of them flying already with excellent results. And I'm sure that Tim and Tuma, who are following, will also have excellent results during their missions.
It's probably unfair to pull one person out of a class like that, but every nation is going to do it when the media turns up. So I'll ask you about Tim. How would you describe Tim?
Well, Tim is an excellent member of the European Astronaut Corps, but of course I have to say this about all the astronauts, and I say this also about our German, French, Danish astronauts, but they truly are, and Tim truly is as well. Tim, clearly from his background, it's also clear that he has great qualities as leader, in leadership, but also in followership. He's very eager to learn. And Tim is very easy to work with as well. So I think in an operational environment, but of course he comes from an operational background, but in the operational environment of the ISS, Tim will do very well.
Like you, Tim's a graduate of the Empire Test Pilot School, and there are a lot of test pilots in the astronaut corps. What is it about them that makes them good astronauts?
Well, I think as test pilots, of course, you have learned very well to follow procedures, which is the primary job as well of astronauts on board of the space station. Every task we do is done by procedures. On the other hand, we also do tasks very often for the first time, which is the same as a test pilot. So the whole mindset in working with procedures, but knowing that it is something that you do for the first time, that something can go wrong, that you need to be prepared when something goes wrong to take the necessary actions. This is an education, this is a mindset that you have, and this makes it easy to work with those type of people on board of the International Space Station.
You said before that four out of six of the 2009 class have already gone up into the ISS. What missions can this group expect to see in the future?
Well, of course, in the future, the main decision that we now have to take in 2016 is the extension of the space station to 2024. Of course, we hope all that the ministers will take that, and that the UK, who started supporting the space station 4 years ago, that they will continue to support the International Space Station program and to continue to support the extension till 2024. And in that aspect, of course, we foresee that the people from this class, hopefully they will all get a second flight. That is at least our goal, and this is what we are proposing to the member states. But beyond that, we also need to look at the new programs, because the ISS, one day it will finish, 2024, 2028, who knows when it will finish, but we need now to start looking to the new, to the future. And that future for sure is exploration beyond low Earth orbit. Our ESA strategy, we have three targets, which is low Earth orbit, the Moon, and Mars. Mars for the moment is robotic. We have our ExoMars program, but we are starting to talk with our international partners to see what we can do as a partnership, not alone in Europe, but as a partnership for exploration of the Moon. I'm not totally unconfident that some of our young people might fly towards the Moon.
You meaning the class of 2009 or the next group?
I think of the class 2009. If the programs go well, if the advancements go well, they will still certainly be of age at that moment to take some of those missions. And we can also think that if we fly to the Moon, maybe we don't want to fly an inexperienced astronaut for the first time. Probably we want to take one of the more experienced guys. And of course, then we will have to recruit from the class of 2009 to do those missions.
Presumably this is tentative at the moment, very tentative perhaps. How would you see ESA involvement in a mission to the Moon happening? What would the steps be in that program?
Well, for the moment we are working on two lines, and we hope, of course, that those lines come together and that there is where we will can see the European astronauts flying to the Moon. The first line is together with the US, with our NASA colleagues. We have a program where we are building in Europe the service module for the new Orion capsule that will fly towards the Moon. But now the service module, we build it in a type of barter arrangement, so it gives us rights to fly to the ISS. This is, by the way, how we got Tim's flight, through an arrangement that we built an MPCV module for the Orion capsule. In the future, in the long-term future, we need to see if we don't want to continue to build those MPCVs for the Orion capsule, but then not for the ISS program, but really for the program of the Orion itself. And then, of course, that would give us rights on that vehicle. And like that, hopefully, we can have one of the European astronauts fly on Orion. Again, this is not for tomorrow, and this is not for the next 5 years. But we need to think long-term in advance in space, so I'm talking here 10 years ahead. On the other hand, we are working with our Russian colleagues on lunar robotic exploration. We have some projects for the Prospect and Pilot, which are technology experiments for a robotic lander on the Moon with our Russian colleagues. But we want to go further. We want to do a lunar polar sample return. On the Moon, there is probably ice on the poles, which would give us water, which is a resource that we could use on the Moon. So we want to examine that together with our Russian colleagues, and that would be the first step to again bring humans back to the Moon and to have boots on the Moon. And then hopefully the two programs, one on the NASA side with the Orion, which can transport people to the Moon, and on the Russian side where we will develop the capabilities and the knowledge to go back to the Moon, hopefully those two programs join together and we have could have an international program of having again humans walking on the Moon. And then of course it's our goal, I think this needs to be our goal of the European Space Agency and the European Astronaut Center, to have in some of those missions also Europeans walking on the Moon. But this is certainly very long-term future. This is not something that will happen, I think, for the class of 2009.
What sort of time frame are you thinking of? And I know, again, it's tentative, but what sort of time frame would you like to see that happen on?
Well, we are thinking of flying towards the moon in the first half of the next decade. So we are talking 2022, 2025 time frame. That would probably be the first flight of the Orion, where probably not a European astronaut will be present on the first flights. It's clear it's an American vehicle. We have just provided some hardware to them. But in the follow-on flights, maybe we could see if there is the will of Europe, because of course that will require investments. You cannot get something for free. This is normal also in the space business and between the partners. So if Europe is willing to invest, then probably on the following flights, we could have some Europeans flying. Having people walking on the moon, that I think is towards the end of the decade at the earliest, or more probably in the early 2030s, I would say.
And you think, again, that would be possible for this current cohort, or would that be the following cohort?
I think the flights towards the moon, certainly not everybody, but I think this might be a possibility that some of the younger people now today, at least that's our plans today. You know, in space, some things sometimes get delayed for 10 years and then they will not be part of that anymore. But the flights on Orion, I think some of the younger people might still see a flight on Orion. Walking on the moon, that I don't think that will be for this class anymore. That will certainly be for another class, a younger class of European astronauts. But again, the focus, of course, also for this class, remains with the International Space Station. This will be our bread and butter for the next 8 to 10 years, and this is where the bulk of the work will be and where the bulk of the flights will be. And this is also where we will concentrate most of our resources.
It's been a really exciting year for the European Space Agency with the Rosetta mission. I'm wondering if you can just share some thoughts on what you think human exploration, human spaceflight brings that you don't get from those kinds of robotic missions.
Well, what human spaceflight brings a lot of things to that. First of all, technology. The technology that we have to use for human spaceflight is not the same that we have to use for Rosetta-type missions, of course. So it's a different type of technology which brings innovation and which brings, of course, jobs to people and which brings a return to economy. Secondly, the partnership. The Rosetta is a mission that we have done in Europe. Human spaceflight today is done only in partnership. None of the nations will have the capability to have big programs going by themselves. And so this, I think, this cooperation, this international and global cooperation brings a form of stability. We have seen even in the high tensions that we have now between our European, but especially also American and Russian colleagues around a number of topics of security in the world, the International Space Station is not touched. We continue to operate, we continue to work together, we continue to talk with each other. And I think that's a very important factor of stability. And of course, in the future, we need to open up the partnership and bring new partners in. One of the most obvious ones, of course, is China, which is also developing their capabilities. Another element that is for sure there is inspiration. I think we have seen it a lot in the UK, but I see it when I go to Belgium. I have, by the way, an event tomorrow in Belgium with youngsters, talking to the young generations, inspiring them, making sure that they also choose for the science, for technology, for math and engineering, which is absolutely necessary if we want to sustain our way of living here in Europe. We will have to invest in innovation. We will have to invest in new technologies. And this can only be done if we have a sufficient high workforce. And this is a problem everywhere for the moment in Europe, to motivate young people to go into these types of careers. And I know that in the UK there is a very big program associated with TIMSS mission to try to stimulate youngsters and to inspire them to go for technology. And I think this is something that uniquely astronauts can do and human spaceflight program can do. So these are some of the elements. And then, of course, there is the scientific element as well. You have the human in the loop. There are research that you cannot do, medical research. For example, we do a lot of research associated to the human body. We can see unique things because we have the absence of gravity that we cannot research here on Earth, or much more difficultly research here on Earth, that we can do. So it's not one of those components that can justify human spaceflight, but if you take them all together, the international aspect, the cooperation, the stability this brings in the world, the jobs, the innovation, the technology, the inspiration, and the knowledge and the science, if you take all this together, I think that human spaceflight is a very good investment for Europe.
What are the challenges that you as head of the astronaut corps face? What are the tough things in your in tray?
The challenges that we face is, of course, working with the international partners. It's clear everybody is paid by their government. Everybody has their challenges, also their ideas, what they want to bring forward. But at the end, you need to sit around the table and come to a common conclusion and fly those crews together in a coherent way to the International Space Station. So this is, of course, one of the daily challenges that we have working with our international partners. On the other hand, preparing the missions, supporting the missions. It's a very long time for the crew. If they have to train 2 years, they are mostly on the road, then they are 6 months in space, then they come back and they will be overwhelmed by requests. And I'm sure that Tim will be overwhelmed by requests of the UK to go and present everywhere the results of his mission. And at the same time, you need to combine this with a family life, with your family, with your spouse, with the kids, also in Tim's case, with his two kids. So we need to be able, as an astronaut center and as an astronaut corps, to support the crew also and also to support the family. So this is something that we are daily working on. We need the crew to keep the crew healthy during all those times. We need to train them. Again, in an international environment, we don't only train Tim, we train also all the other international astronauts that will fly with Tim. So this is really the challenges that we have in the day-to-day work, I would say. And then, of course, the big challenge is how do we go from where we are today and the space station, which again today is our bread and butter and where the bulk of the people are working, but how do we gradually start preparing the future that I talked about some time ago? And again, this is not the biggest budgets that we have today, but if we don't prepare today, we will do nothing tomorrow.
How can you support those families of the astronauts? Because behind a lot of astronauts is an incredibly supportive spouse, whether it's male or female, sometimes children involved as well. And they do have to move around a lot. They don't see a lot of their partners. It's a tough thing for them. And what sort of things does ESA do?
It's indeed a tough thing for the spouse and the partners to support the crew when they are traveling around, when they are 6 months in space. We have a number of programs, of course. First of all, we have a number of people that are here dedicated to the crew support, especially to the crew that are in the mission. We allow the spouses to visit or to travel together with the crew members. I think this is very important if you're away for a long time and you go to all these exotic places like Star City, and that at least the spouse, the kids can be there once as well. They see what you're doing. They it's not an alien place. They know where you live. They know the people there, so they can much more relate to what you're doing there. I think this is very important. We provide, of course, the crew members and the spouses with all the necessary connectivity. And then once they are on orbit, there is a whole program where we have the support for the spouses to upload pictures, to upload stories. There is communications means on board of the space station. Once per week, there is a two-way video conference that we implement between the spouse and the crew member. So these are the number of things that we do. I think that the most important is practical things that you can do to help them. Okay, we are always there for them. If they write an email, we will always try to support them.
Getting back to some of the broader challenges that the astronaut corps faces, how have you handled the loss of the shuttle? What impact has that had on your astronauts?
I think as astronauts, we are very well aware of the dangers that there are in spaceflight. You refer to the shuttle, which was in my era, the class here was not there yet. And some of us, of course, lost friends and colleagues there. But we are very well aware of it, that this is a risk of the job that we are doing. But if we look more recently, we had three cargo vehicles just recently blown up on the launch pad or during the launch. So flying to space today is not easy. We are aware of that as astronauts, and we have full confidence, of course, in the ground teams that do everything possible to make our flights as safe as possible. And there, of course, one of the bigger aspects that go into that is as well the training, because the training teaches you a lot, certainly in the Soyuz, about the vehicle, how to operate the vehicle, what to do if something goes wrong. And as a crew, I think you have a lot of confidence the moment that you step to the launch pad. You have a lot of confidence that if something goes wrong as a crew, you can take the necessary actions to at least hopefully save the mission, but to at least save your lives. But okay, we don't have to be shy about it. Space flight still entails risk. And in a risk-averse society that we are living today, sometimes it's very difficult for people to accept. But we are astronauts, we are scientists, we are test pilots, test engineers, and we accept that risk.
Since the shuttle stopped flying, the only means of getting into space is the Soyuz. And that must put pressure on the astronauts and on you yourselves, or must make it difficult. I'm wondering what you see as the answer to improving access to at least low Earth orbit.
The fact that we can only fly with Soyuz does not necessarily put stress on the astronauts or on me here as the head of the astronaut center, because the Soyuz is a very safe vehicle. We have seen now, I don't know how many crews or years now we have operated the Soyuz successfully. There are a lot of redundancies in the Soyuz, and even if we had little hiccups here and there, a solar battery, for example, that did not deploy, which happened recently, we see that the vehicle is very solid and very robust towards those type of failures. So from a crew perspective, flying with the Soyuz is not at all an issue. From a program perspective, of course, it's different, because if you're the program manager of this international program and you're reliant on one single source for a critical issue like crew transportation, this is not very good for the program. And this is why on the US side, of course, they are trying now to make the commercial crew available as soon as possible, so that we have, again, two different types of vehicles with which we can fly towards the space station. And I think this is a very sound decision from the program side. We hope that the commercial crew comes online quite soon. It will also augment the number of crew members on board of the space station from 6 to 7, which will dramatically increase our time for science, because this extra crew member will be almost entirely dedicated to scientific activities. So I think this will be a very good step forward for the program whenever this commercial crew vehicle comes online.
So you have companies in the US who are looking to provide access to space privately. Does the European Space Agency want to have its own means of getting astronauts into orbit as well?
One of our goals, of course, as the European Space Agency, is to be involved in the transportation, because transportation clearly is a high technological area. It's a critical area. You're on the critical path. You can build most beautiful houses you want in space, like the International Space Station, but if you don't have a vehicle, a car to get there, you cannot use it. So it's really a very important aspect of human spaceflight, the transportation. Today in Europe, I'm sure that we have the technological capabilities to do that, but we don't have the political will or the resources to put into an own European transportation system. And this is why we have partnered up with NASA. We are on the critical path for the Orion vehicle. We are providing to NASA the service module of the Orion capsule. Without the service module, the Orion capsule cannot fly to space. So we are part of the system. We are part of the transportation system. We do not provide the launcher or not a capsule, but at least a very important element, critical element for the mission. And this is where I see that we will go in the future. And this is where I hope that Europe will continue to invest in the future, so that we can continue to be part of the transportation system, the future transportation system of NASA. And as being part of that future transportation, also then to have the rights to fly on Orion and to have some of our astronauts fly towards the moon. This is what I really hope that our member states are prepared to do. It's not the huge investments that are required as of building our own transportation system, which I don't think today is either necessary nor supported by the member states, but at least be part of a transportation system built together with our partners. This, I think, is an absolute must for Europe.
What would you like to see Britain doing more of in terms of its involvement with ESA? Are you happy with what it's doing? Would you like to see it shift its emphasis at all, or any changes you'd like to see from the UK government?
Of course, I would be happy that any government in Europe does more in space. We have to see, in Europe, our space budgets are rather limited. If you compare this to what the other countries are doing, and especially if you compare to what NASA is doing, we spent in total about 5 billion euros in space, all the programs together, not only ESA, but also from the European Commission and the national programs. If you then see in NASA alone, without all the other agencies, in the U.S. that work around space, by the way, DOD, the Defense Department in the U.S. is the biggest space agency, and not NASA. But NASA alone is spending 3 or 4 times more money than we are spending in Europe. So of course, I would like for Europe to spend more. Today we spend about on human spaceflight €1 per citizen per year, to fly our astronauts to space and to develop new technologies, to do science, to inspire the next generations. I would happily see this doubling or tripling, €2 to €3. I think it would not be a huge investment, but I think it would be a worthwhile investment, because, again, we have to see, this is not a cost, this is an investment. Space is an investment into the future. And of course, I would like to see this investment increase all over Europe. And of course, in Britain as well, I would like to see that the UK continues their engagement that they have started in the International Space Station. But when we are going to explore to the moon, to Mars, I hope that this will also inspire the UK government, of course, to do a little bit more and to join ESA in our big exploration of the solar system.
Hollywood, at least, has been embracing space in recent years. We've had films like Gravity, Interstellar, The Martian. Do you watch these things? Are you a fan?
I've watched all of them, and I think it were great movies, indeed. Certainly, they have a very realistic aspect to them. Of course, not completely. It's a story. It's a Hollywood movie. We all understand that. So you have not to look at it with the eye of an astronaut. Is that now really the truth, or can this now really happen in space? But they bring a certain aspect of realism, of inspiration as well towards the big public. And I think I'm a big fan of that. I'm a big fan of Star Trek, by the way. So this is the reason why I wanted to join the space program, because I watched and I still watch all the Star Trek episodes from time to time. So I think these movies also help the space program, not only, but certainly youngsters, to inspire youngsters to choose for careers that are inspiring and that go beyond what we normally do.
In those films, though, there must be moments where you're looking at it thinking, that's ridiculous. What did you pick out from any of those films as moments where you think, come on, I know it's a story, but...
Or if you look to Gravity, for example, where the main character at a certain moment flies to the Chinese capsule and then immediately knows how to operate the Chinese capsule, on which he has never trained, because it's somewhat similar to a Russian capsule. This is clearly a little bit beyond what we think that is possible. But also the pure mechanics, for example, the fact that you get one satellite that is hit by another satellite, and this creates a storm of space debris. This is, of course, not at all in line with the laws of orbital mechanics, which are physical laws, so it's not at all in line with physics. But again, this does not matter really much. The idea behind is still good. The idea that you can have space debris, which is dangerous for our systems, is a real threat today. Again, the Space Agency, our European Space Agency, has several programs working around that and is thinking how to clean up all this space debris. The fact that we have to train, and that by good training you can adapt to different situations, probably not a Chinese capsule, but I'm sure that Tim will be challenged in his mission with situations that were unforeseen, but the whole 2 years of training will help him getting through those situations. And this is, I think, the realism that you have to see behind the immediate picture that you see.
Did you understand Interstellar?
It was difficult, I must say. I really found it a very interesting movie. I've seen it now three times, I think, because I wanted to understand more and really get the concept of it. But again, is it reality or not? It doesn't matter so much. The fact if you can look behind that saying, look, if we continue with our planet, what we are doing today, we're really going to mess it up and we are not going to be able to survive. So we need to change something in the way what we are doing today is one message that you can get out of the movie. The other part is that, okay, one day our planet will end. We know that in 5 billion years, the Earth will not exist anymore. Punto. That's a reality. That's a fact. That's not science fiction. That's a fact. So if as human species we want to survive another 5 billion years, we will have to leave our planet. We will have to travel. We will have to find another place to live. Will it be some stations around Jupiter where we walk around in circles? Who knows? Maybe it will be something completely different. But again, the fundamental idea behind it, I think, is right.
Tim's mission is going up in December. How will you be feeling on that morning when they're going up?
He will be feeling excited. He will be very happy, I think. He will be smiling from ear to ear. And then the moment that he gets into the capsule, it will all be serious and work and very concentrated, being on the start of the mission. The most difficult moments I found for me were when you get into the capsule, you do all your normal checks that you're used to do in the simulator that you have done maybe 10 times, 20 times, 30 times. But then, of course, you go to the capsule a little bit earlier, not a little bit, a lot earlier, than is necessary because you never know something happens. You want to have some spare time. You don't want to be rushed on the day of launch and saying, I just finished the last check 2 seconds before the launch, you know? So then there is normally a period of about 30 minutes, at least 30 minutes if every goes well, where you have nothing to do. You just have to wait because you have finished all your checks, everything is ready, and now you just have to wait for the launch to happen. And these are, of course, the most difficult moments because you have nothing to do and you start reflecting by yourself. You're sitting on top of a rocket full of liquids and fuel and petrol that is going to shoot you to space. And then you're gone for 6 months and you know that a lot of people will be watching you. You know that you have a very intense program. You know that thousands of people have worked on your program to do all the science, to do all the work that you need to do. And then it will all depend on you to do it correctly. And then you start reflecting on that and it makes you quite silent, I must say.
What do you think he'll find toughest about being in orbit?
The toughest on being in orbit changes with the time. In the beginning, a lot of astronauts suffer of space sickness or some dizziness in the beginning, some small headaches or aches in the back. So you don't feel physically fit the moment that you arrive in space. By the moment that you arrive, maybe yes, but a couple of hours later, not so much anymore. So that's certainly a challenge in the first days, but luckily this all goes away and then you adapt very quickly to microgravity. In the beginning, when you come to the space station, the challenge is certainly to find everything and to find your way around, because the simulators that we have on the ground here, they look very clean. But then if you look to pictures of the space station itself, there is stuff everywhere. There are computers everywhere. There are cables everywhere. There is cargo everywhere. There is science everywhere. And then to find your way around it and to find something, in the beginning it's quite difficult. Also, when you work in microgravity in the beginning, things float away. You lose things very easily because you think that you put them somewhere, but then they float away and it's in three dimensions. You never find it again. So this is quite difficult in the beginning. But again, there you adapt. It takes a couple of weeks, not a couple of days, a couple of weeks, months before you're completely adapted to the environment and to the microgravity. And then, of course, when you are about three, at least in my case, 3 to 4 months in the mission, then most of the tasks you have done already once. And then the repetition starts. If you have to clean the toilet for the seventh time in a row, it gets a little bit boring, I must say. But it needs to be done anyway. So then you start really looking forward. Can I get home? And then the last month is again different because then you say, oh, it's almost finished and I still have to do this. I still have to do this. I still want to do this. And then you want to stay longer and longer again. So there is again a different challenge. So you have different challenges throughout the mission, which is okay as well, I think, because it's changing.
How will you be feeling that morning when they go up?
I feel always very concentrated. I'm there with the families. I will be next to Rebecca the morning that they go up. And of course, it's an important step for Europe every time that we launch an astronaut. It's very important for the UK. I understand it's the first ESA astronaut from the UK that will fly, not the first UK astronaut that we all know. So it's an important event, I think. But I will for sure be there with the family, with the kids, and trying to support Rebecca. Because one thing is to see a member of your astronaut corps go up. Another thing is to see a very good friend or a spouse go up. I had one time I assisted in a launch of one of my closest friends, and I must say it's a different feeling. So I can relate very well how the family is feeling at that moment. And so my biggest job will be there to be with them and to support them.
Being an astronaut is far more than flying around in space, but I'm wondering if when you see these guys go up, or, you know, knowing that you have ESA astronauts up there, does it make you miss it a bit?
Oh, absolutely. I would give up my job immediately now in 1 minute if they would offer me to fly again to space. But again, there is a time for everything. We have decided to recruit 6 new people. I think it's good. I've flown twice to space. I'm very happy with that. I would be extremely happy if I could fly a third time. But I understand it's more important that these young people fly for the first time to space. So I don't have the best job in the European Space Agency. The best job is being an astronaut and flying to space. But at least I can say that I have the second best job, being the boss of the astronauts and being able to support them to fly to space. So I'm not unhappy at all.
Frank, thanks so much for talking to us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Frank de Winner talking to me in Cologne. And we'll have an interview with the British astronaut Tim Peake on the show just prior to his launch into space in December. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Frank de Winner. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.